It's Wednesday, May 16th, 2007, and you're listening to episode 52 of Fear the Boot, a show about tabletop role-playing games and a little bit more. Running time for this episode is 55 minutes. Welcome to Fear the Boot. My name is Dan, and we've got a short staff today, but that's okay. That's actually really funny given what we were just talking about. We were talking about Dick. Yeah, we were talking about people with names.
Funny names.
Names that are strangely close to genitalia.
Dick Pole.
Yeah, and I had a math teacher whose name was Harold Richard Taylor, so his name was literally Harry Dick Taylor.
Yeah, so, we used to work with a guy named Richard Dick.
Anyway, Dick. So coming to this thing, we're short-staffed is a very bad...
It's a great pun.
Yes, it's great. And if we have to re-record for whatever reason... We're doing this whole bit again.
Actually, it wasn't even an intended pun. So anyways, getting on with it. My name is Dan, and on the mics with me today is Chad.
Howdy.
And Adam.
Hi.
And before this, we were actually trying to record a bonus episode on the play-by-DVD D&D Adventure Scourge of Worlds.
It was awful.
And it was so... We had so many issues with it. The bonus episode was pointless. Like,
I was bored with the bonus episode.
Usually on Fear the Boot, when there's negativity... There's negativity followed by some kind of purpose. I mean, okay, granted, we make our passing stabs, like, you know, Chad will say Shadowrun sucks, or if I took a dump and what came out riffs or something. But typically...
What happened to me today?
When we go into long kind... Actually, I got a story about riffs, too, but I'll come back to that.
Excellent.
When we talk about these longer, you know, these longer rants about why we don't like something, usually we back it up with some kind of explanation. And there was nothing there.
Well, you can't justify bad. It was bad. Why?
We came away with one positive thing to say about it. While it was on, I was playing around on Amazon and Wikipedia, and we found the homepage of the lady that did the voice of Lita, and she is smoking hot. That's the only thing nice we have to say about the whole thing.
I approve.
And I'll put that in the show notes just so you guys can do your own research.
We also had some very nasty things to say about WotC game designers, but...
Yeah.
It's nothing we haven't said for 50 episodes.
All right. Yeah. Now, on riffs, here's the thing I have to say about that.
Here we go.
Got an email from a listener
who extended to
me...
An invitation to play a riffs game.
No, kind of. Not exactly. He has extended to me a riffs challenge. Here is the way that the riffs challenge works. He basically wrote in... And I would love to give you this guy's name, but his...
Is it Dick Johnson?
No, it's some like, I don't know, I can't even pronounce the name. It's obviously not his real name, so I'm not clear on what his name is. But anyway, this gentleman writes in and said, look, I've had some pretty good risk games, and I don't understand quite why you guys hate it. And I responded back to him and said, well, just to clarify, we do have a lot of issues with riffs, but I, too, have played in some riffs games that I really enjoyed. And I can find things, at least personally, in the books that I like and I think they did well. So our passing drive-bys on riffs, you know, maybe aren't properly nuanced, but the...
No, it's a really terrible game.
Oh, and I even said in that email, I said, Chad just unabashedly hates the whole thing cover to cover, but...
Some of the cover art's nice.
The challenge that he gave to us was he said that there's apparently some kind of a new consolidated, updated Rifts single book that's out.
You can't consolidate crap and have it be better.
Well,
when you consolidate crap, it just squishes out the side of the cover.
He said you guys should pick it up, take a look at it, maybe play a game. And we are at least going to meet him halfway, because when I was looking over the stuff for Ziggurat Con, one of the games that's being demoed down there, I believe, if I remember their order of little games right, was Rifts. So we will probably send them a copy of that book. That might be one of the books we pick up.
And so you're going to send our brave fighting men and women that biohazard that is Rifts.
Well, haven't you seen those communists? Haven't you seen those Marines commercials where show them doing like push-ups and scaling walls and like fighting those great big flaming golems and playing riffs, then chasing down Osama? Then
yeah, he's playing. He's holding the big riffs book, flipping through, and he's like, "A Marine can take anything."
So, DJ, whatever your actual name is, we are going to pick up that book. And while I will not send the gaming guys a used book, I will at least sit down and thumb through the book and kind of get a sense of what's
so
in there
it will be used.
Before I send it.
It'll be gently used.
Yeah, no pizzas on it or anything like that, like we have on my Robotech books.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah. We straight face down pizza on a Palladium Robotech book.
I was hungry, okay?
All right. I bet.
Getting this train back on its twisted tracks. Two announcements real quick.
Oh, business, business, business.
The first is, once again, Worldwide Wing Night is going to be Friday, May 18th, which I believe...
May 17th?
No, 18th. Oh, it is 18th.
Okay. Right. Do some fact-checking here.
Friday, May 18th. Yes, I was right.
All right,
so Friday, May 18th, which I believe by our release schedule will actually be the Friday right after this show is released. So if you guys like wings, you like beer, or you just like gaming, hook up with your local gamers, get some beer and wings anyway, and send us some pictures of it.
And we also have an unconfirmed appearance by Lida.
We have sent out that invitation in the bonus episode that we haven't actually released and don't tend to release because it wasn't very good.
That's okay. I'll try and get her.
All right. Do what you can.
Oh, what if I can get an interview with her?
What would we say?
Who cares?
We'd be like, why? Why, God, why?
That won't be the first time.
You know that movie you're really known for? It was horrible. We were pretty good looking. I mean, where do you go with that in an interview?
I mean, anywhere with it.
That was our first pass on the Seamus Young interview, and that just didn't work out at all.
Who are you?
Well, what we do is
I'm a webcomic artist.
What is the web? Internet. Know you're really smoking hot.
Then after he hung up.
Then after the police left, we tried a different tact. But anywho, I believe here in St. Louis, 7 o'clock, right, at that one place in Fenton.
Yes.
And we will meet up with you guys there that are coming.
And we will meet up with the world as we raise a toast to Worldwide Wing Night.
And also, have something I want to pass along. This isn't exactly an announcement. It's just a tidbit of news. There is a
car with its lights on in the parking lot?
It's a little late now. These episodes are like 10 days behind. So this was actually something that was posted to a discussion forum that has been set up for the people that make these gaming podcasts. And Mike Stackpole, who many of you know from various books and things he's done in the RPG industry, made a post on there coming off of the Gamma Trade Show, which is an internal industry trade show. And I wanted to pass along a couple sentences from it. I said, this isn't really an announcement, but these are words that I think are very worth repeating. And what he wrote is he said, the Gamma Trade Show is focused on helping brick and mortar stores do well. While we all know we can buy stuff cheaper on the net doesn't provide us a place to game or to indulge in demo games or to teach other folks how to play games. The industry needs gaming stores as a place to infect new gamers with gaming. And he is completely and absolutely right. No, Chad says he's wrong.
I don't know. I game in people's houses with friends and stuff. I mean, I like my local gaming store well enough. I've made friends there and such, but if my local gaming store closed down, because I actually know the owner of my local gaming store, I would never want his stores to close down. It really wouldn't impact me that much.
Well, I'll go back to your old local gaming store, which did close down.
It did close down.
That I don't even think you knew about
it. I did.
Months later.
Yeah. I was even like, Dawn, let's go up to such and such a shop. And we went up there. We're like, well, oh my God, it's
closed.
Here's the point. I guess we'll go to a different place.
Here's the point and why I agree with him. The local gaming store, you're correct, looking over my history as a gamer, has not provided me with really that much, because of the fact that when we went up there, like we said on the show many times, we like to game deeper character-driven, story-driven games, and all the people in the gaming stores we ever went to were just power gamers.
Yeah.
I mean, to say the least.
And honestly, nothing against them.
No,
they were having fun.
Right, they were having fun, and
there's not our fun.
That's great. But the gaming store, as a result, never played much of a role in our lives as gamers. Outside of, this is where we got a lot of our books from, because this goes back to the days pre-Amazon.com. But
pre-Intertubes.
What I will say, however, is I do recognize the fact that the presence of these stores, where people are conducting games, and the gaming books are on the shelves, and games are being demoed, and your friend who is a gamer says, hey, you ought to come with me while I run an errand over here, I understand their importance to the hobby as a whole. I mean, this is, I don't say they're the front lines. I think gamers themselves are the front line in gaming evangelism. But this is that second line.
It is one of many resources and places. That's how I see it.
I see where he's coming from. And I've said many times, we got nothing at all against the folks that do their business entirely online. I personally buy almost everything I own online.
Including his socks.
Including socks. Actually, yes, I have ordered socks off of Amazon before. But I do understand the local friendly gaming store. So if you are in the market for a gaming book and you're debating between Amazon and the place that's two doors down, unless the place that's two doors down has really pissed you off for some reason, and we know plenty of horror stories about places like that, at least consider hopping in your car and making the drive over there and, you know, picking it up from them. Because I do understand the role that they play within the market. So not too much to say on that, because that really wasn't a major topic of conversation. So let's roll right along into the next thing. And this was a debate that almost started on our forum, except Chad and I, both of us, were frothing like raging caged animals.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
We were prepared to spring forth, and both of us, I think you even actually wrote MHMH like, you were stopping yourself from talking because this is such a great topic of a podcast.
Yes.
Wow. Should GMs cheat?
Yeah. But how you're defining cheating.
Okay.
If you're defining cheating as, okay, the player walks up to the orc and stabs him and kills him, and I'm like, well, gee, I really like that orc. Well, okay, I'm behind my little GM screen. Oh, he rolled his dodge. Oh, the camera focuses on the die behind the GM screen. It's a one. He's lying.
Dun, dun, dun.
Yeah, that's not even cheating. That's pathetic.
Yeah.
Yeah, so no, I don't really agree with that. What I would more say is the orc smashes his mace into the player's head and splatters his brain, and I, the GM, kind of reach over and click the dice because it's the first 5 minutes of the first game and it's his first character.
Orc who is mindlessly going after one guy, nearly kills him for no particular reason, changes targets.
Yeah.
And some people might say, well, based on our two examples, is our advice you should cheat in the player's favor but not against them.
And we're kind of setting up
I don't think the GM should cheat ever.
Well, the way I look at it, we'll let Adam take his position here before we...
No, that was a summation of my position. Continue.
No, you're going to have to defend that.
Ah, damn it.
But before we make Adam fall back into his stronghold and resist our assault, the way I would say it is the game master should cheat for the sake of creating and preserving enjoyment.
Yeah.
The game master, in my opinion, should never, ever, ever cheat simply to get his or her way. Yeah. I have played in games where I have my character, the big bad, super bad guy comes up, says all kinds of crap, pushes us around, intimidates us, and I kill him fair and square.
No, you didn't.
He suddenly has hit points he didn't have before, and shots that would have killed him didn't kill him, and all of a sudden then he kills me, just because that isn't what was supposed to happen. And in my mind, I think that's a terrible way to conduct a story, because if you're going to do that kind of stuff, why don't you just... I'll just sit here. Why don't you just tell me what happens?
Yeah. It's the first night of the game, and you do a plot hook where a thief steals the coin purse off of one of the characters because you want him to follow the thief to the thief guild where you're starting the plot. All right. And that thief shimmies over a wall. You know, it's like a garden wall or something. And goes running off. And the players are like, okay, let's chase him. I'm like, yeah, guys, go get him. And the first player jumps over the wall and totally botches his roll, his little dex check, because he wants to pole vault over it or whatever, and lands on his head, and it kills his character. Just dice. It's just dice. Yeah. It's like, doink.
Yeah, I click. Agree. As a game master, I cheat very, very, very minimally because of the fact that I like, to a certain degree, the chaos of the story. I like, first of all, allowing events to happen as they fall, and secondly, I also very much believe wholeheartedly all a player has in this game world is one character. Yeah. Whatever they do with that character, they have earned and they get to keep.
I like the idea of character death, but I hate the idea of lame character death.
All right.
Okay. All right. Let me amend my position. I don't think the GM should ever cheat. However, when the retarded situation comes up,
yeah,
where, okay, I've just shot myself with a bow. How does that work? How did I just kill myself with a bow? How has that happened? And everybody at the table is like, that is dumb. Okay, that's a general agreement among men at a table. That's a gentleman's agreement that this shouldn't have happened.
Yeah.
So I guess if I had to boil my position down, I would say that I will cheat as a GM, but only specifically if it is done to, like I said before, preserve the enjoyment of the players.
Mm-hmm.
Adam, what could, if you...
I don't think it's fair.
You seem stricter than I am in that
regard. I do. I don't think that you should cheat at all. I think you should just let it fall where it is.
Within reason.
Within, well, yeah. I mean, with, when, notwithstanding, you know, retarded rules, situations.
Yeah, when the rules bend the reality away from the reality of the game.
Yeah, yeah. When every single person at the table, GM included, everybody there is in a total agreement that this is stupid and shouldn't have happened, then okay.
I think GM cheating is generally stupid because if you do it outside of these very limited examples we're giving, one of two things happen. Either you're cheating in the player's favor, in which case you're basically just protecting their consequenceless charge through the world.
Yes.
Where I walk down a hall and the floor opens up and there's poison spikes and scorpions down this pit.
I throw myself on the spike so others can walk over me because you won't kill me.
Yeah, exactly. Or I walk up to the orc king and I smack him in the face.
Yeah.
For no particular reason, but
right,
just
Phil,
because
calm
I
down.
Can. Mm-hmm. And on the flip side, if the GM is cheating in his own favor, that the player's like, well, I'm going to steal the bad guy's bag, and that had the orb that the game was all about that they weren't supposed to get for 30 more games, and
well,
you don't
guess,
let them...
guess what? The orb's not in the bag. The players didn't know.
And I'd say let them have it. Because
oh,
I think
I don't know about misdirection.
It depends on
misdirection, I think,
to
is
my story.
Well, because here's the thing. The way that I see it is at that point, you as a GM, if you have to cheat, if you have to say, you had in your notes or in your head or whatever, that bag contained the orb the story's about and they stole it, and you have to say, I must take that away from them to keep the story going, I think that shows a lack of adaptability as a GM. That I think just as
Doing misdirection,
I think just as
is adaptability.
The GM throws the players challenges, and I think the same way the players should be allowed to throw the GM challenges.
Yeah, I agree. That's why I'm totally against, well, I guess in the sense of dice cheating, because if I get into an argument with you're the GM, I get into an argument, a rules dispute, you'll win every time.
Yeah,
it's
you
your
control
work.
The rules.
Yeah. The only thing that I have is I rolled a 20, you rolled a 1, I win.
Yeah.
There's no way you can beat me then. Well, I mean,
provided I don't know.
I
think that
win.
On the misdirection thing, I think that misdirection is just one of many tools in a GM's toolbox. Now, if the magic orb, and they're spying on the Ogre King, and the Ogre King is eyeing the magic orb, and they know what it is, and they put it in his pouch, and he puts it there, and they go in, and they do this long thing, and they steal the pouch, and they get back to the village, and they open up the bag.
And it's not there.
And inside is a chicken. Oh, boy, I'd be pissed as a player.
Yeah.
There better be a damn good reason.
I think
why
you can move around what I
there.
Don't know, but if you mess with things that I do know for no good reason, then that's cheating.
Yeah.
So it seems we're all in agreement on at least one point, which is whether we can agree on the details or not, we do agree that cheating should be employed very, very limited.
Yeah. So, and I don't know. I think that when you call it cheating, you're talking about something else. You're talking about the malevolent, sort of mean-spirited GM who is in conflict and competition with his players.
Yeah, the GM shouldn't be trying to win.
This is not a game that you win or lose. It's a story you're telling.
Well, No. We can all lose.
You win or lose by whether at the end of the day, everyone, GM and players included, stands up and says, damn, that was a great game.
Right.
We'll see what it gets next.
Yeah, they go onto our forums and post a woo! You ever had a gaming session like this?
Yeah, exactly. It is not a competition, and the GM does not need to cheat to win and should not be cheating to win because he can't win that way. He wins by telling the players a good story.
And he owns the universe.
Yeah.
You can't find a better way to do it.
All right. Continuing our stuff on GMing, I got an email from a guy, and this one I do have a name on, whose name is Andrew McGrory. And excuse me if I mispronounce your last name. That's my best stab at it. And he is a guy from the same gaming group as Chris, who we answered some questions from several weeks ago. And what he was asking me about is specifically things that are related to enemies. And he had a whole battery of questions about how we handle bad guys within our RPG. And I thought that quite a few of these were worth tackling on the show. The first one, and this is, from what I understand, a relatively new gaming group, said, what do we prefer in terms of quality versus quantity? Do we prefer to go after the high challenge, big fights, or would we rather send 100 orcs after them?
Is little fighting as humanly possible. In fact, I consider if I can go an entire campaign without a single act of overt violence, I have succeeded.
Okay, so I'll answer the question then.
Yeah, I disagree. Well,
I would rather have smaller fights because initiative takes so, so long.
You know, I didn't even think about it from that angle. The way I was going to answer it and the way that I run at my games is it depends on the moment. That there is a certain dramatic appeal, and you can think about this in a movie. There's a certain dramatic appeal to when they walk into the room and there's 100 zombies coming after the actors. And, you know, there's a certain kind of horror and drama to that. But similarly, there's a certain kind of drama to they walk into a room and the floor splits open and this one gigantic thing comes up from below to attack them. And I would say the exact same thing is true in a role-playing game. I don't think there's...
Well, I'll say this too. From a storytelling perspective, one zombie is far more frightening in the right context than 100 zombie okay. in any context.
Now, if we're going to talk about quality versus quantity in terms of description and setting, oh yes, quality every time. Yes. I agree with you that one zombie, well-placed, carefully described, doing the right things, is almost always going to be far more effective of a storytelling device than that sea of zombies.
And you know, again, you have to have players who are into it when we're talking about this, because it's like, okay, that one zombie rises from the dark and the stench and the darkness and the evil emanates from him. And then the five players are just like, pound, pound, stomp, 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 pound, 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 stomp. All right, that takes care of that zombie. Well, you might as well have 100 come out then.
Yeah. So, I don't know. I think it also depends on what type of combat it is. Okay, you've been playing this campaign for a year. There's an assassin squad out to get you. They walk in the door. It's showdown time. Or, similarly, there's 100 military guys chasing you. Do you really roll all their initiatives? No, man, you kind of fudge it, and you're running back, and you're shooting behind you.
But if you fudge the initiative, that's GM cheating.
It's not GM cheating, because it's the point of the combat. Mm-hmm. Is the point of the combat that you're actually going to sit down and fight this one out? Yeah. Or is it
something else
that's going on?
Some people are into that. Some people, and I just don't mean power gaming. I mean, some people are like highly simulationist. They have the deep storyline. They have the deep characters. They have the high role playing, and then they have the strategic tactical combat where they're all about that.
I'm not opposed to like abstract fights, like the city is being sieged.
You have 100 guys. Yeah. Roll one die for initiative.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. The battle is going 18 out of 20.
Yeah.
Good job.
Well, I think in situations like that, you're doing abbreviated actions anyway, because it's more like you're not going to beat these people. It's just kind of a question of, are you firing into them to keep their heads down? Are you running away? Is one of you trying to call for help? I mean, you're just trying to get a sense of how they're handling it. It just kind of fuzzes into the area of combat because people are shooting at each other. But in truth, it's really more of a role-playing moment.
Yes.
So I think the short answer to this is I personally think I would go with the quality over a quantity any day of the week, but I just think depending on, I'd look at the kind of emotion you're trying to capture. I mean, what is the purpose of this encounter in the game? If it's just to give the players something to fight, I'd say the encounter probably doesn't belong in there.
If it's just a time sink, you're just trying to bulk out your story, you need more story.
Yes.
It's a six piece of shambling mounds just because that's what you rolled on the chart. I don't know that I'd even use it. So
Now, if it's part of the action, if it's part of the flow of the story, if it's something that's supposed to happen, if it's something the players brought upon themselves, I'd say go with as realistic as possible within that situation and within what the players can handle, too.
The one thing that I would recommend against doing, and it's very
rolling on charts for enemies.
Well, yeah, that too.
Making the enemy not able to be killed.
It's very easy to do, but, and I did this as a GM. Just about every GM I've ever played under has been guilty of this, creating what we call the video game plot, where you think back to games like Double Dragon or newer games like Ninja Gaiden or whatever. Well, the current one, that is, the original one's pretty old. But where you basically fight through, it's like zombie, 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 vampire. Where it's just you fight through mobs.
Boss fight.
Exactly. Where you fight through these mobs and mobs and mobs of nameless, faceless, quantity over quality enemies. And then
the boss music plays.
And then you have
plays,
the boss fight.
And then you punch him until he starts to flash red.
It actually got to a point in one of our Star Wars games where I was sitting there with a laptop next to me, and I actually had the Final Fantasy VII boss fight music on it.
Oh, I love that song.
And whenever the GM threw an enemy at us that we knew was a boss fight, I just reach over and double-click that MP3 file and let it go.
That pleases me.
His second question about bad guys, and this is one, it's a really good question. I actually wish we would have thought of ourselves and tackled at some point earlier in the show.
Yeah, let's just say we did.
Okay. This is a question that we came up with ourselves, and coincidentally, he also asked about an email.
Bam!
Which is, all right, you've got a bad guy for your campaign, okay? Let's say that the players are out wandering around the lands, and
I take one of Phil Hicks's old characters.
Yeah, you know what?
You know what's funny? And continuing the whole parallel of how Tim and Phil are like exactly the same as players, Tim's PCs made the best villains I had ever seen. Mm-hmm. When the Game Master would take away one of his characters, they made the best villains in the game. But, okay, that aside, getting back to our example, let's say that you've got the parties going around the wilderness, and somewhere there's an evil baron, and we all know who that baron is, trying to manipulate the...
I surrender.
I join him.
I drink from his mug. But you're trying to find out he's got some kind of master plan. How do you reveal things to the players about that villain without the direct encounter? And the reason he's asking this is, let's say, for example, that the villain maybe has some depth to him. That he's not just generic evil man.
Hardboard generic evil, just like all the players are generic good.
Baron von Badass, he has a D20 brooch.
And winged boots.
That means evil.
But let's say, you know, you have a villain who's not just generic evil, but actually has some depth to him, has some reasoning behind him. How do you let your players in on that information?
Well, if he's a baron, he has to have serfs of some sort. Evil doesn't just happen. So it's got to be manipulated, and there's got to be other people in on it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's one possibility. You could use underlings along the way who, upon being captured or whatever, there's the old trick of...
torturing them?
Well, torturing them. There's the old trick of you kill an underling who has a letter to or from the overmaster that might let in on something.
Well, they do have to communicate. I mean, it's overdone.
You don't see him necessarily, but you see his actions, and then you see the effects of his actions.
Yeah, like he goes into one town and destroys it and goes into the next town, and the town's in great shape, and they're like, yeah, he actually fought the orcs off on our behalf.
Right.
And
but when you step into that first town, you're like, oh, the good baron, he's not quite so good. He destroyed this town. And then, you know, then you go to the next town, and then it's like, oh, he fought the orcs. There's a great battle. Oh, well, he is good. And then you go further on, and then you learn something. It's like, oh, that other town is in his employ. They were just lying to you. Oh, he's bad. Oh, I'm so conflicted because I'm just generic good.
And another trick is you could run into people that have known him, childhood friends.
Mm-hmm.
People that he knew from the past who might give you, and you can't be too overt,
and, you know,
because you can't.
If we're talking D&D, you just cast detect alignment, and then you know.
Well, we're trying to avoid that kind of metagaming.
No, that requires a proximity.
All right, fine. Let's get this out of D&D then, because D&D is becoming a bad example. So let's
because you made me watch Scourge of Worlds.
Scourge of my soul.
Now it's seared eternally into your mind. So
there are no blue lips.
All right, so let's say that we're playing, I don't know, we'll use Battletech. It's one of those books is sitting right beneath the D&D book in front of me, so we'll go with good old Battletech. As I say, you could have people that have known this person in the past who might give you some insight. I think you don't want to get too ham-fisted, because if it's just like you know nothing about this guy and then you run into his mom who just like tells you everything about him, it just becomes cheesy plot exposition. I think part of what you've got to do is let this stuff out slowly.
Let the players discover it.
Yeah, let them discover it naturally. Don't just stuff it in their faces.
Yeah, that's why I like having, well, two things really. I like having the players see the actions and the effects of what the person is doing. And I don't like running good guys. I don't like running bad guys. I don't really think that there's too many people out there who are 100% good and 100% evil. You know, there's shades of gray in all of this, and I like presenting that conundrum to my player. Another thing you can do is, geez, have him meet him. Make a really, really good character.
This actually leads into his next action. He was at, his final question was, how do you, oh, actually, I'm sorry, we have one more. His second to last question was, if you run into a bad guy, how do you keep the players from having an instantly violent reaction to that bad guy if you want them, like you said, they meet the guy. And the,
how they know it's him?
Well, I have two bits of advice on this.
I have a gaming story about this.
No.
One is know the players and know the characters. Because if you can present the enemy in such a way that either they cannot fight him at the moment because, like, they have a bigger enemy to deal with, like it's in the middle of a running battle and he
Or the bad guy, so it's because a huge retinue of guards.
Yeah,
and
I was going to say, that's one I don't think you want to overuse because it becomes very
frustrating.
It's also very railroad.
General has an army.
Well, he does, but it becomes very railroad when every time you want to talk to the bad guy, he shows up with an army you can't possibly beat and captures you, and you have to listen to him.
I attack them from behind.
it's realistic. It's believable. I'm not saying don't use it. I'm just saying don't make that your generic way of ever having them meet the bad guy.
And also, talk to your players, like, out of character. Say, don't go to them and say, do not kill this guy. Because then you're just asking for them to kill them or they'll resent you. But talk to them and say, hey, you know, let's try and develop a story here. Let's try and develop a dialogue. And the first answer should not be a first strike policy.
Yeah.
You know, let's talk
I agree
to
with
the
you.
NPCs.
And don't metagame talk. Don't be like, hey, I'm about to bring up an NPC and you guys should talk to him, not kill him.
This More, is before the game.
Yeah, outside of the game, sit down with your players and be like, look, guys, I'm trying to develop a deeper story here, and part of that may be conflict and violence, but be in character. I mean, in real life, believe me, every one of us runs into any number of jerks in a day.
I kill every single one of them.
And our first reaction to them is not murder.
This is what I hear. Hail, adventurers. I roll initiative.
Bam!
He's just said hello. I roll initiative.
Well, this was the guy that did some minor annoyance thing to us previously within the game, or is circumstantially involved. And
I wait till he's not looking.
This is the merchant that's cheating all the villagers of this town. He deserves to die by my hand and through my brand of justice. Out in a tree, I'm back. Well, okay. Wow, that's scary. I don't think I want to run games for you anymore. But you know what? That's how a lot of games are run and such.
Yeah.
Well, and like teenagers, I mean, hell, that's how we used to play.
Yeah, oh, exactly. And I can think of even the best example I can think of for this kind of villain interaction was a D&D campaign. And I know I said I was trying to get away from that game, but a D&D campaign
right back
that
to the original.
I ran several years ago for the other gaming group that had a villain who, through most of the plot, did not have an army with him.
Right.
The only person that was typically with him was his younger brother. And this guy, he was not like, oh, this guy's way out of your power level. They and people along with them would have been capable of taking this guy. But I would bring him in up in situations where, like you said, he would do something very good, then do something very bad. And I knew that the players were playing characters that were deep enough that if they ran into this guy, drawing swords was not going to be the first answer. They were going to at least be like, what are you doing and why are you doing this? And in those moments, he could kind of let them in on a little bit of his motivations or something. Or one of the times they ran into him where they would have been willing to kill him was they were up inside this great big tower surrounded by much greater powers. It's like, we can't take this guy right now because if we're busy fighting him, the much bigger and badder forces that are around us will come in and kill all of us.
One of the things that I like to do a lot in my games is make the players need him. Or at least I present a guy that's not a good guy.
Yeah, I hate that.
And the players are in a situation where they don't want to go it alone. They can, and I'm not going to stop them. And it isn't going to be an impossibility for them to go it alone. But they really don't want to go it alone. And I present a guy who will go with them, work with them, help them, and he's not a good guy. And they have to make a decision. I don't stop them at all. They have to make a decision of, am I going to take this guy out or am I going to work with him?
Yeah.
And you know what? There's consequences.
And
to
you know
both
what's
actions.
Funny is in that game I'm talking about, they completely turned my story upside down. Because there were three or four major sides that were all in conflict. And the one that I had pegged as the ultimate bad guy, they talked to him, and they kind of started to see where he was coming from. And I was playing this guy as a fairly deep character. They actually talked him out of some of the stuff he was doing. And they ended up siding with the guy that I had pegged as the ultimate bad guy.
Yeah.
And that radically changed the game, because all of a sudden, my big super villain is now not really a super villain anymore. He's more kind of, in D&D terms,
he's just kind of super.
In D&D terms, he's kind of running down the neutral line and ends up working with the party. Because, of course, it's an RPG. It's about the party. The side that wins is the party side. That's just the way it goes. And they sided with him. And so it's like, okay, he can't be the ultimate enemy now. He's somebody else has to be. And I had to change things around and raise up a new power to oppose him.
I remember there was a Skies of Glass game that you were running. And we go into this town, and this guy is making this speech in the middle of town, basically rousing these people to fight who you just came from, or who we just came from, something like that. I don't remember the exact situation. And I just walked up to him, and he's like on this platform, and I walk up to him on the platform, and I basically lay into him, not physically, but I'm just like, you're doing this and this and this, and this is all wrong, and we're going to stop you. And then the guy starts making this speech. And the way my character was, and the speech you had him made, and the things that you knew that I didn't, he lined it all out, what was going on, and my guy just stood there on the stage, dumbfounded, like, you're not a bad guy. And I just can't hurt you now. And I just kind of, my character just kind of stands on the stage dumbfounded.
And what allowed that is the fact that we as players make the choice coming into the game that we're going to play characters that are deeper than, oh, teehee, I kill him.
Yeah.
I am Fytor.
I battle axe his head.
Hey, man,
my sword thirsts for blood.
Let's find battle. All right, his final question on enemies, and this one is, strangely,
more questions. How many questions does this?
As long as you don't answer this one, the gaming stories. You know why people keep asking us to record a game? It's because of gaming stories like that.
I know. We give these teasers. It's like the
these gaming stories we give are not that
good. Oh no, it's like the movie trailer for Star Wars Episode One. The teaser looks a whole hell of a lot better than probably what the actual product is.
I didn't see any
is.
Pod racers in the teaser.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. You didn't see any Jar Jar Binks in the teaser.
You know what we should have done? We should have made characters on the mics tonight and then not released the episode. Ah!
All right. Anyways, last question. This one's a little more mechanical than what we typically answer, but a good question.
Is this guy paying us for all these questions?
Most people
just give us one and we answer it.
This guy, he gave me the third degree.
So. This is going to be a bad trend to start.
Is he threatening your family? Is that it?
Yes.
Okay. Read his question then.
His last question is, if we are playing a game that has a battle map, and this could be a...
No, I don't.
Well, I know you don't use battle map. But let's say, even like in the days old, remember we used to have those big newspaper pads and we just sketch out the room and just put down stuff so we could tell where everyone was standing?
And Penny.
Yeah, well, exactly, because it got too confusing. And he was just asking us, how do we represent people we don't have figs for?
Pennies?
Man, yeah, coins, dice paper are clips. Great. Dice are great. If there's six orcs, take six different six-sided dice and put one with one up, one with two up, one with three up, one with four up.
Another way is to take, tear little squares of paper, put an arrow on it, and then put initials on it.
Yeah, just be careful because one
achoo, blast,
yeah, or one
splatter.
Dumbass flips his book closed in a hurry, and they're all
shut up.
we've used coins, chess pieces. The one that we use right now is
salt shakers.
You can get these. We've inherited the slang term dauber, and I don't know if that's their proper name.
It's not. It's glass fish tank rocks. Like, you go to a pet store, and this is the nice glass beads that you put in
the
bottom of a fish tank.
Ones.
Or, like, if you have fake flower, your mom has fake flowers, and it's a clear vase, and she puts it in there, and they put those colored beads in
it
and stuff.
And if you use those, because you can put those down and be like, okay, the blue ones represent orcs, the white ones represent goblins, and the one red one in the middle represents the chieftain.
The guy who introduced those to us called them daubers.
Yeah, we don't know where he got that
one. I still use daubers.
Yeah, I call them daubers.
I don't know if that's the right term or if that's just one he made up, but that's...
I thought it was because it was just a daub of glass.
Maybe.
Did I just make up the word daub?
I think so, but I like it. We'll go with it. It's now FTP 9000 compliant. Dauber is in the FTB lexicon now.
You totally said FTP the first time.
Maybe I did.
Alrighty.
I can't deal with FTP every day.
This has actually been a pretty advice-heavy show, but
you mean that was the banter topic?
Oh, now that we're moving away from banter?
I'm done talking about this. banter.
All right, Chad, this is another one. This is a whetstone in the mind of Chad against which you could grind a great many axes.
Claire,
our advice portion today, how to successfully run a low magic fantasy game. All right, so we're not talking a medieval game. We're not talking like...
Get some Fritz Lieber.
We're not talking some historical...
Some Robert E. Howard going.
Knights of Europe.
Yes. Stop looking at me like that.
Oh, yes. Those are books I never got you to read.
Yes.
All right, how do you run a low fantasy game? And I came up with two methods. One...
Rip off the masters.
Well, I guess maybe three. Yes. One is you simply... You take your D&D player's handbook and just limit what people can play. That you just don't allow people to play classes that have a lot of overt magic. You don't make them common in the world. And if there is a mage in the party, he's the only one.
Or you go on Amazon.com, you order a book by Fritz Lieber called Ill-Metten Lankmar.
No, I read that.
You read that cover to cover, and it was wonderful, right?
Yes.
You read it cover to cover, and then you run a game based on that. It is it's low magic. I mean, basically, you have... all of the adventure and the story that you normally have, and you can even have the monsters and stuff in it. No dwarves, no gnomes, no elves, no fairies.
Hold on. Let's define low magic. Magic doesn't exist because medieval.
Are we saying low magic or low fantasy?
Well, hold on. I don't know. You could come at this from many angles. I think...
Well, let's pick an angle.
Well, but here's the thing. I don't know that we can. What I would say is, all right, if we take high fantasy, which we define as having a lot of magic,
yes,
having a lot of mythical beings, which would include dwarves and elves, as well as dragons and swamp monsters in it, and we say that all these things of myth and legend are there in great proportion, a low fantasy game or a low magic is the reverse of this.
Yes,
now,
thank you.
I think, quite frankly, you could have a low fantasy game where you have tons of dwarves and gnomes and stuff, but they also don't have magic. And I think similarly, you could have a low magic game where maybe you have, okay, there's a few more wizards and clerics and such than you would have otherwise, but you don't have all these mythical creatures running around. You don't have dragons and gnomes. I think there's any number of things in between.
I think that a low magic game to me, if you just boil it all down, is where magic is actually special again and not commonplace.
Well, yeah, I think there's even this...
It's not necessarily overt either.
There's this implication in a lot of fantasy storytelling that, okay, the dragons are dying, there aren't that many left,
nobody
sees them
anymore.
Oh,
no, not that plot line again.
Magic is rare, wizards are rare, blah, blah, blah. But for the entire next 30 games of this campaign...
Nothing but wizards
and dragons. And you as a player are supposed to feel special because that's rare. But it's like, no, within my experience as a player, which mind you is now 5 minutes old in this world, I haven't lived there all my life, this is what everybody's day consists of because this is what my day consists of.
You know what I like about a low magic setting? Hmm. Magic doesn't exist. It is commonly believed that magic does not exist, but every once in a while things happen.
Yeah.
Maybe shouldn't.
You can't be lazy as a GM either because you lose magic as a storytelling device.
That's very true.
The wizard did it can't be the answer to every question anymore. Well, when they come to a door and they beat it down, it's magically sealed, can't be a common answer. And you suddenly have to deal with, okay. You know, one of the ways, actually, Chad, and this is something that you suggested years ago that I think is a great way to run a low fantasy game.
Another thing I don't remember. Go.
But no, it was good.
It's new to you.
I know.
It's new to you, again, is to have magic within the game. And as I said, keep it rare. Mm-hmm. Not that many people use it. Not that many people know how to use it. Maybe everybody believes in it, but it's more superstition than reality. But what you do with the magic is you look at some of the spells and effects that might be offered in D&D. And instead of using them as spells, you turn them into long rituals. Okay, mm-hmm. So for example, let's say that there is a witch out there.
I got this thing about cults.
Right.
I love cults.
Let's say there's this witch out there that's like trying to hex the party, okay? Mm-hmm. She won't show up and cast like some kind of debuff on the party.
Yeah, and then fairy dust springs from her
hand. Right, and then you throw a fireball back at her, and then she throws a lightning bolt at you. But it's more like...
You failed low magic.
Somewhere off in the background, this witch, who if you confront her, her probably only weapon is screeching loud and swinging a cane at you,
and she's stinky,
has put together this medicine bag of evil that has, as long as this exists, like every die you roll is at a -1 or -2 penalty, mm-hmm. or the game master will have certain things go against you, or she casts lightning bolt. That it's not per se that she walks up and tosses lightning bolt, but as you guys are walking along, this unnatural thunderstorm comes out of nowhere, and the wagon that you guys are riding on suddenly gets struck by lightning, you know, mm-hmm. or the town finds itself aflame because...
Or people just stop liking you.
Yeah, exactly. You know, things just start changing.
The key is to make it there, yet undefinable. It's just things happen.
Slow and subtle.
Slow. Like you walk into a pasture of sheep where you've walked in there hundreds of times before, and you've been doing this since your childhood, and the sheep come up to you. Well, you walk into the pasture and all the sheep walk away from you. They don't run away. They don't scream. They don't burst into flames. They don't start bleeding dinner. From their eyes. They just go away from you. Little subtle things like that. I also think that a really good low fantasy game would be a game that had absolutely no magic in it whatsoever, but it had a high amount of superstition.
Yes.
Everybody believed in magic. And you had mages in the party who would go through the ritual and who would do all this stuff, and it wouldn't do anything. But they believed it would. And they would go with it, and everyone else would believe that it would happen.
Well, is that a low fantasy game, or is that a no
fantasy
game?
That's a no fantasy game. And I think that would be a really interesting one to do, and you can also twist things into it. You can also start putting little bits of magic into it, like the only magic that actually exists in the world is ultra, ultra, super evil magic. Like if you really sell your soul to demons type of magic. And the players don't necessarily have, if a player wants to have access to that, he's got to make some serious deals with me, which is going to be worse than his player making deals with the devil. And, you know, and it's like all this superstition and belief and religion versus this sort of demonic,
right,
you know, cursedness. I think that would make an interesting setting.
All right, so we've talked about scarcity, having magic be rare. We've talked about having magic be different, changing the nature mm-hmm. of it. I think you can also get it by just toning down the power of the magic. That, for example, right. I don't know, let's say you're running a Western campaign and you have a tribe of Native Americans, that they have maybe even a fair amount of magic, but it's more like folk magic and hedge magic, right, where it's like, well, this will cure this and this will induce visions. It's not like...
And half of it...
It's not like I want to whip this at you and throw fireballs, but it's more, I can do these very, it's common, but it's all very low key.
And half
of
it is real magic, the other half is peyote.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, an interesting thing too, this is one of my biggest beefs with high fantasy, not necessarily in novels, but in role-playing games. All of the spells are combat spells. They are either spells that do damage, spells that get you into combat, protect you from combat, or get you out of combat, or somehow maintain combat.
There are a lot of spells that don't. They're just not very popular.
No
one takes Conjure Water.
Oh, I do. Why would you? I do. I can break any D&D game by playing a spellcaster and taking nothing but utility spells. Because if you are creative and resourceful enough, you would not believe what even the simplest of little parlor tricks, and I'm not, you can even be in a dungeon by yourself. The stuff you can get out of, if you just pull these MacGyver moments with, like, create water, light, and cure light wounds, and you just know how to apply them all together. I won't give you any gaming stories, but...
Thank God.
You'll give us a gaming story off the mics. Fabulous.
Now, you guys were saying, and I don't have an opinion on this because I have to confess that I've seen the movies but never read the books. I intend to read the books, just haven't done it yet. But I just finished Shogun, and now I'm working through Crime and Punishment by Dostoevsky, so I'll get...
Ooh, the Russian classics.
I'll get to Tolkien eventually, but...
You haven't read them?
You guys were saying that Lord of the Rings, in your mind, is low fantasy.
I'm the only one who's read the books.
I've read The Hobbit.
Okay,
I've said that The Hobbit is low fantasy.
Okay,
I can't speak towards the other books.
It's interesting because of the
fact...
And
I've heard theories about the other books,
Lord of the Rings was obviously the template for D&D.
Right.
And Lord of the Rings is a template for the entire, most of the entire fantasy genre. Yes. I wouldn't say all of it, because fantasy goes way back.
No, it's all of it. Okay. Fantasy genre is pretty bad out there.
I'll agree with it, that modern fantasy is largely based on it, but a lot of it also comes from folklore.
Well, folklore and fairy tales and such, some of which are very fascinating. But that aside, if you really want to hear about that, this is what Harpy Mick does. But that aside, it has become the template for modern high fantasy. Yet, you guys were saying that you thought the books themselves were actually a low fantasy series. And I'm curious, because at least when I watch the movies, there is so damn much magic. You know, that you have elves everywhere.
Where?
Magical robes.
Well, here's the thing is that...
Lambus bread that is a whole meal off of a bite.
Well,
and
here's the
orcs
thing
who are magically created and wizards and...
Well, it's like... Now, and this is, again, I haven't read the main books.
Okay,
I've only read The Hobbit.
We're just talking... In your response, Hobbit only.
Hobbit only, and then also theories and talking to people who have read all the books and the Silmarillion and all that, and they can speak Orcish and all this sort of crazy stuff. The general idea that I'm getting is, like, a lot of the magic that, say, there's only, like, four people who can cast magic spells in the entire world. And a lot of the magic spells that get cast in such spells, so to speak, can really be explained away by gunpowder and parlor tricks. There are monsters in the game, or in the stories. Elves, I don't think that anywhere in the three books, again, I haven't read them, does it ever explain that the elves have pointed ears? They describe them as aloof and what their personality is like, but they don't necessarily describe them physically as we traditionally know elves. Hobbits are, of course, I could be wrong about this.
This is a conversation that we need Johnny G for.
Yeah, yeah. And Johnny G and I have had this conversation. I mean, there is magic in it. The focus of the story isn't on the magic. You know, there's a couple of powerful artifacts in the game, but it's not like every single person has magic items.
Right.
You know, and it's
even in the original releases of it, they took most of that out. They never talk about the cloaks, the rope. They never talk about... the Lambus bread. They never even explained that in the movies. It's all kind of brushed under the rug.
Well, and then they
have
the star
like
in the bottle. The star in the bottle and the sword that glows when orcs are near. And, and it's all that stuff. That's why, listen, I've not read any of the books at all. But just off the movies, it struck me as being, I don't know if I'd say it's the highest of high fantasy, but I mean, I would put it at least a medium fantasy. Mm. No, I agree. There's a lot of things that aren't like, I mean, if you go into the town, at least from the movies, if you go into the town of Gondor, there's not a damn bit of magic in the entire city.
Let me put it to you this way. My favorite scene in The Hobbit is just, I really hope that they one day make the movies, although I don't think they will with Peter Jackson, because just so I can see this one scene is Smaug is this old dragon, and he's dying, and it's painful for him to even move, and he's just old and falling apart, but he's still a dragon, and he's ultra powerful, and he's flying over the town, and he's, you know, spraying fire and killing people, and the leader of this town is like this hunter, and he has this bow, and he takes out this arrow, and it's a black arrow, and he puts it in the thing, and he says, "Yo, This is the black arrow of my forefathers. You have killed many stags for me and my father and for my grandfather. And strike this dragon down." And he pulls back and he lets loose. And the arrow goes straight into Smaug because there is one scale that's missing. And it goes straight into the hole and it kills him. It never once says the arrow is magical. It is special because it's special to him.
Right.
And to me, that is more powerful and more interesting of a storytelling device than 100 magical, glowing, flaming arrows.
Even at least within the movies, at the very start when they were doing the plot exposition intro of the first movie, they even kind of did talk about that a little bit because they talked about how things faded into legend and kind of got knocked out of proportion and such. So I don't know. Like I said, I really don't have a strong opinion on this either way until I get around to reading the books. But it'll be interesting to read them from that perspective. And to ruin the ending of The Hobbit for any of you that haven't read it yet.
Snape kills Dumbledore?
Smaug kills Dumbledore.
Excellent.
That black-hearted bastard.
Smaug could be anywhere.
So we will give you guys a whole week to think about that, and we will catch you next time.
See ya.
This has been a production of Fear the Booth. This show is copyright 2007, fully owned by its host. The games, movies, and other properties mentioned in the show are the property of their respective owners. Listeners are free to use the show in any non-commercial endeavor as long as credit is provided to HearTheBoot.com. You can find previous episodes and other resources at HearTheBoot.com.